I don't listen to fanatics that try to tell me how to blow my horn. And I guess that's why I've been playing 40-some years, you know? And if they just listen to that horn now, they're getting the best trumpet that I ever had in me.
Louis Armstrong was a musical genius and a phenomenal performer who revolutionized jazz and made a tremendous impact on the development of the trumpet as a solo instrument.
He extended the range of the horn. He just expanded the whole expressionist aspect of the trumpet.
When Armstrong held the curved, shiny brass tube up to his lips and sent blasts of air through the horn, the sound that emerged was joyful, electric, and direct from the heart.
He did things on that horn that nobody had done before. He made it into a beautiful kind of, you know, romantic, rhapsodic instrument, or he could make it into a real screaming brass thing.
I'm Nancy Wilson, inviting you to join Stanley Crouch for this special edition of Jazz Profiles, Louis Armstrong, the Trumpeter.
When Louis Armstrong played the trumpet, he, like so many American virtuosos, made it look and sound so simple. But as effortless as he made it appear, Armstrong possessed a unique blend of talent and dedication that hasn't been exceeded by any trumpeter since.
He was a virtuoso on that horn. I mean, he did things that can't be done. You know, it's just ridiculous. He could play a fast passage, and it would be like an hour in between each note, it would seem. That's what kind of time it was, you know what I mean? I mean, how could anybody do that?
Two of Louis's many disciples, trumpeters, Ruby Braff and John Fannis.
At that time, trumpet players were not supposed to be playing above a high C on the trumpet. And Louis Armstrong came along and started playing a fourth, a fifth higher than that, to where people would come up to him after the concert and look at his instrument and think that he had a special instrument or some kind of special thing that would make him be able to play in the upper register like that. But it wasn't like that. I think that was just his talent and his personality coming out of the horn, and that's what he forced himself to do.
Louis Armstrong used both the trumpet and his voice to teach the world to swing. His swing was one of his greatest cultural contributions. Musician, educator, and scholar, Gunther Schuller.
It's the energy, it's the drive, it's the momentum of the music, and that energy that makes it impossible for you just to sit by without snapping your fingers or tapping your toes or something.
Did away with the traditional two-beat rhythm and laid a foundation for swinging with an innovative 4-4 beat. Trumpeter Ruby Braff.
Before Louis, a lot of those bands, you know, they played very corny. I'm not saying that the talent wasn't there, but it's kind of corny, you know, and rinky-tinky, you know. But Louis changed all the world of phrasing because he put the world into 4-4, you know, instead of 2-4. That 4-4 feeling. And the minute everyone caught on to that, no longer were they playing that oldest album. From then on in, it was the elongated phrasing and running over past bars and everything, see?
While he was a master at rhythmic improvisation and harmony, Armstrong always advocated pure tone and great concern for the melody. When he began recording popular tunes, his gift for melody and tone brought him a wider audience. Dan Morgenstern directs the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University.
From 1929 on, Armstrong's repertory definitely became one of what later turned into standards, because he launched probably more evergreens to be than any other performer, starting with Ain't Misbehavin' that came out of the Hot Chocolates show that launched Armstrong on Broadway. And there were many others, of course. The first jazz musician to record body and soul was Louis Armstrong.
Whenever he played, Armstrong had a unique way of interpreting a song. He had an ease and a confidence that you could hear from the very first note. Here is the culinary celebration, Strutting with Some Barbecue. John Faddis.
He had a wonderful sense of time, a wonderful sense of rhythm. I think his attitude, the way he gets from one note to the next, the way his solos propel forward with time, I think that was a big factor in the development of swing, because everybody who came after that had to go back to Louis Armstrong.
He loved to sing on the trumpet. I don't mean now vocally singing. I mean playing in a singing style.
Gunther Schuller.
He loved the sound of his trumpet. Just the gorgeousness of that sound. Perfectly centered, full, rich, expressive sound with a marvelous vibrato.
And think of this. He has never been heard on stage, on record, anywhere in a movie, as ever having made an error in form.
Ruby Braff.
What kind of a brain could do a thing like that and never make an error? Ever, ever. Nothing can be subtracted or added to anything he's ever done except by him himself, the sculptor.
Just like a sculptor molds a ball of clay, Armstrong molded his music from his roots in New Orleans. Trumpeter and band leader Wynton Marsalis observed that Louis Armstrong drew on musical traditions hundreds of years old, and he knew how to reinterpret those earlier sounds and make them all his own.
The great ones, they always know much more than their generation, because they know the generations before them. He understood what all those great trumpet players were trying to play. From King Oliver, he got his conception of dignity. From Bunk Johnson, the kind of smoky tone. Buddy Bolden, the bravura sense of the trumpet player as a leader. He distilled all of their styles into this one super style.
I'm Stanley Crouch. It's Satchmo, the wonderful world of Louis Armstrong, a very special edition of NPR's Jazz Profiles in celebration of the Louis Armstrong Centennial. On this show, it's Armstrong, the trumpeter. Like most jazz musicians who came of age in the first half of the century, Lewis never had formal musical lessons. But as a young boy growing up in New Orleans, he absorbed a cultural jambalaya of sounds that featured both street musicians and virtuosos like Sidney Bechet and Buddy Bolden.
At that point, there were tended to be two kinds of jazz, and again, I'm oversimplifying. There was Creole jazz, which was dance music.
Lawrence Berggren is the author of Louis Armstrong, An Extravagant Life.
And this was performed by reading musicians. They read music, and they read from sheet music, and they played the notes as they were written, pretty much. What Buddy Bolden was performing was more like street music. It was much rougher, it was more improvisatory, and it was much wilder, and in some ways you would say that it was the precursor of the kind of jazz that was to come later. Armstrong actually drew on both tributaries of this stream.
Although he started off singing and playing drums, Lewis taught himself to play the bugle when he was about 8 years old. He grew up next to the red light district in New Orleans and would hang around outside of the nightclubs and the bordellos to hear the musicians play. His arrest at age 12 resulted in his being sent to the Colored Waifs Home. In some ways, Armstrong's incarceration may have been a mixed blessing, as writer Lawrence Berggren explains.
He, for a couple of days, thought this was the end of his life and the worst thing that had ever happened to him, as he later realized this was the best thing that had ever happened to him, and it was a turning point for him musically because he soon joined its marching band, which was its big claim to fame. The fact that he could wear a uniform and get musical lessons. And he'd had a few kind of informal ones before that, but get some real musical training. This was just the right situation for him.
Lewis talked about sitting in his room on Saturday nights at the Reform School, absorbing the sounds of trumpeter Freddie Keppert, who performed at a nearby club. Lewis studied the work of Keppert and Bunk Johnson, but his greatest influence in New Orleans was King Joe Oliver. He taught Lewis the basics, how to read music and perfect his technique on the horn. Here's Dan Morgenstern.
Joe Oliver took the time to actually look after this talented young man, give him pointers, show him how to do things on the trumpet. I mean, he almost took young Louis, little Louis, as they used to call him then, under his wing.
And I was a fly, making all kind of variations, and because I was so fast with fingering, and Joe Oliver said, no, play lead, play more lead on that horn, so the people can know what you're doing.
After Oliver moved to Chicago shortly after the end of World War I, Louis Armstrong went on to work with other popular jazz musicians in New Orleans, Kid Ory, as well as Johnny and Baby Dodds. Lewis was also the lead cornetist in one of the most popular marching bands in New Orleans, working both weddings and funerals. He was hired to play in a riverboat band led by Fate Marable. Night after night, they cruised up and down the Mississippi, entertaining tourists.
Every band has a certain number they open up with. And our opening number was, In the Land of Beginning Again, we'll do that. The rest of the evening, we got it made with the rest of the numbers and everything. So anybody that ever had a band knows what I'm talking about.
And here was another opportunity for Louis Armstrong to improve his technique and experiment with developing his own style. Writer, historian Dan Morgenstern.
That's where he really became a full-fledged professional. It was Davy Jones who played mellophone as well as saxophone in the Marable Band who taught him to read music. And they were playing for white audiences. They were playing for white dancers. He learned a lot about that. And he also learned a lot about personal conduct.
The lessons served him well. His old mentor, Joe Oliver, was keeping up with Lewis's progress and hearing very good things about him. Oliver offered Armstrong a place in his Creole jazz band, playing second trumpet behind Oliver. In 1922, Lewis left New Orleans, carrying among his possessions
a trout sandwich made for him by his mother, and he boarded a train headed for Chicago. Music historian and band leader Gunther Schuller.
In those very early days, in the early 20s, there were no parts written for a second trumpet. So Louis had to sit there, listen to what Oliver was playing. He had to create an independent second trumpet part which would provide harmony for King Oliver. So there would be two trumpet parts in harmony, and yet at the same time not interfere with the trombone part, for example, or double some of the other melodic parts that might be going on at the same time. I can only describe it as walking on a tightrope.
And Louis Armstrong was up to the task. He broke new ground, improvising an independent line that didn't clash with the melody or step on the toes of the other instruments. At the same time, he developed brilliant harmony lines.
My tone was so strong, and I was a young boy there, 22 years old, you know. Lord, I'd blow the bubs out of anything. But Joe, you know, he was getting up in the age, and he didn't preserve his chops. And when I played this recording date with Joe Oliver for the Jeanette the first time, they had to rearrange everything. Joe would be right in the mic with his trumpet, and I had to stand way at the door to play second trumpet. They'd blend it, you know. It was just a little light solo, but I like the phrasing in it.
That's Pops improvising that second line on Mabel's Dream with Joe Oliver on lead trumpet.
As Armstrong, you know, as he now was beginning to get out of his teens into his 20s, eventually surpassed Oliver as a musician, both in the astonishing power of his blowing, because Armstrong at that point was, among other things, a fabulous athlete at the trumpet. I mean, just, you know, his sheer blowing power was extraordinary.
Armstrong biographer, Lawrence Bergman.
Armstrong's virtuosity was so astonishing that many times classical musicians from Chicago, white classical musicians, came to hear him to see what he was doing with this instrument because they couldn't believe the sounds he was getting out of the trumpet.
Louis Armstrong and King Oliver with their 1923 version of Sugarfoot Stomp.
Stronger than his. See, I would never play over Joe. That's the respect I had for him, you know. But if he would have thought of it, he'd let me play the lead. You notice all these records you hear more harmony because his lead was weak.
Lil Hardin played piano in King Oliver's band and eventually married Louis.
One night, Joe says to me, he said, this is before Louis and I married, he had told me this. He said, Louis is a better trumpet player than I'll ever be. He said, but long as I keep him playing second with me, I'll still be the king.
It's a well-documented fact that Lil Hardin helped Armstrong perfect his technique and style. Lawrence Bergman.
And much of what we consider to be the Armstrong sound and distinctive Armstrong phrasing, he got from her. For example, she noticed that he was a wonderful whistler. He was just whistling for his own amusement. But she tried to get him to incorporate some of the phrasing and riffs that he was using in his whistling in his trumpet playing, which he actually did. So that gave him a distinctive voice as a trumpet player.
Perhaps due to some financial hanky-panky on King Oliver's part, Lil eventually convinced her man to leave Oliver's band and go out on his own. Louis had no trouble finding work.
I played in a symphony orchestra in 1925 for Silent Pictures, And we played everything you hear these big orchestras playing right there in the Vendum Theater in Chicago. And we play an overture, then we go into the jazz, quite nicely, that's how I got in there, but still in all the experience I had by being there, waiting for myself to come in with the jazz chorus or whatever it is. But we play an overture first, and there's the experience. William Tell was nothing after I was there 2 weeks.
When he moved to New York City in 1924 to join the number one jazz orchestra, Fletcher Henderson's, Lewis became the prime soloist. Here's Gunther Schuller.
At that point, he was ready to really fly, so to speak. And with that previous experience of being in this almost boxed-in situation, having to create these independent lines, now he could go further with that and create really beautiful melodies entirely of his own making without having to follow King Oliver.
Here comes the Fletcher Henderson Orchestra performing Copenhagen with Louis Armstrong.
Fletcher had a great band, one of the first big bands, colored bands, that hit the road. But he would never give, okay, how good you was, he wouldn't give you over 16 balls to save your life. I played third trumpet in the band and jump up to first trumpet, hit the cat's high note and get back to the foot. And all he would say, if you're gonna be good someday, you take some lessons.
When Armstrong came to New York, he wasn't yet the fashion plate that he would one day become. Consequently, the well-tailored members of the Fletcher Henderson Orchestra looked upon him as a country bumpkin. Once he commenced to play, however, they realized that he was the one wearing the tuxedo, and they were the ones standing on the curb barefoot in rags.
Every place he goes, he leaves disciples.
Writer Gary Giddens.
I mean, they are born again musically. I love the Fletcher Henderson Band as the ultimate example because we have documentation. We have pre-Armstrong recordings, and then 6 months later, we have post-Armstrong recordings, and they're all playing differently, and the arrangements are different, and Coleman Hawkins is different, and Buster Bailey's trying to swing in a different way.
His popularity grew in 1925 when he put together a studio band called the Hot Five. That first group recorded one of Lewis's compositions, Cornet Chop Suey.
Chop Suey. I never told you the difference between a cornet and a trumpet. See, the cornet is a little shorter than the trumpet, which sound the same. But the time I was playing in the symphony orchestra with Erskine Tate, he one day asked me to change from the cornet to the trumpet. Said, not that they don't sound good and all that, but it's just that they don't look the same sitting in the symphony orchestra and I'm sitting there with a little cornet beside the trumpets, you know? So I changed, and I liked it better. I think it was a more mellow tone.
Thank you.
change from cornet to trumpet when he worked with Erskine Tate in Chicago resulted in another level of Armstrong achievement. West End Blues was recorded in 1928, and ever since, trumpet players have tried to copy Armstrong's introduction, but few can match his virtuosity. Trumpeter John Faddis.
And King Oliver played it one way, but Louis came along and with his personality put a different attitude, a different style to it. Louis widened up his vibrato and gives it a totally different style, totally different attitude.
Louis Armstrong's boundless energy, which allowed him to play for hours with fire and charisma, extended the range of his trumpet. Trumpeter Harry Sweets Edison.
When he came to my hometown of Columbus at the Palace Theater, the symphony musicians indicated he had a trick horn because there's no horn made and no mouthpiece made that a trumpet player could play that high. He could play all night and still never miss a note, you know. The symphony musicians took his horn and found out it was nothing but an old stock mouthpiece and a Selmer trumpet. And he said, told the fellow, said, well, since you're so curious about my mouthpiece and my horn today, I'm going to hit 200 high C's and I'm going to end on a high F. And he counted them one by one on the stage. It was just holding up his hand and hitting high C's and just going from one end of the stage to the other. And when he hit 200 high C's, the mouthpiece never left his mouth and he ended up on a high F that would just shatter the lights.
We'll have more on Louis Armstrong, the trumpeter, from musicians who continue to benefit from his rich legacy. I'm Stanley Crouch. You're listening to a very special edition of Jazz Profiles, the wonderful world of Louis Armstrong. Armstrong was one of a kind. He could interpret a musical line, improvise on a popular theme, or boldly rephrase a melody like no one else. It's not an exaggeration to say that you'll hear his licks in the work of every trumpeter who came after him, including the late, great Harry Sweets Edison.
I just dreamed about Louis Armstrong. He was just one of a kind. You know, and I don't think nobody has captured Louis Armstrong's feeling, and nobody ever will. There's only one Louis Armstrong, and will only ever be one Louis Armstrong.
What a man, do you know what it means to miss New Orleans?
Armstrong's skill at improvisation paved the way for the emergence of the jazz soloist. With his electrifying stage presence and daring innovations on trumpet, Louis Armstrong revolutionized the sound of jazz music in the 20th century. Writer Gary Giddens.
He gave jazz a life beyond the specifics of the notes. It was a spirit, it was that buoyancy, it was that optimism, it was that this modernism in its best sense of the word. This is the new world we're into, and he is the embodiment of it.
Trumpeter Doc Cheatham has gone on, but before he died, Doc said he spent every day of his life studying Louis Armstrong.
He not only plays the songs, the lead, of the melody, but there's something in that man that I don't think anyone else has. And it comes from within him somewhere, in his makeup of his brain or his heart or what it is. It's a God-given gift to that man.
You know what it means? You miss New Orleans, since that's where you left your heart. And there's something more, I miss the one I care for more than I miss New Orleans.
The amount of influence Louis Armstrong had on me was powerful, and not so much volume so much as the amount of conviction.
Trumpeter Nicholas Payton.
Even if it was somewhere he missed a note, everything was precise. He knew exactly what he was doing, and he was always had that confidence behind it.
By the 1930s, any young trumpet player heard his influence coming at him from every direction. Even if they knew they couldn't imitate him, they were also aware that Armstrong's innovations were indelibly infused into the music, because you couldn't help but hear some of his licks in everything all of the musicians did. Ruby Braff.
Miles said it very well when he said, "Everything good did you ever hear was done first by Louis and Better."
Armstrong's influence was so pervasive that it extended beyond the trumpet to all other instruments played by jazz musicians. Here, in 1928, is his collaboration with the extraordinary pianist Earl "Father" Hines. Armstrong biographer, Lawrence Berggren.
Earl Hines heard Armstrong playing in Chicago and tried to capture some of that phrasing on the piano, which he did. It was called a trumpet-style piano playing.
Mm-hmm. awe and respect of his peers could be heard in the work of some of the most influential bands of the day. But even in 1970, when Duke Ellington wrote his New Orleans Suite, he hadn't forgotten. He included Portrait of Louis Armstrong, which reaffirmed the grand feeling that Armstrong had when he touched everyone.
There is such a close relationship between the music of those two giants.
Writer, historian, Dan Morgenstern.
There was hardly ever a time in the history of the Ellington Band, except for the very earliest period, where there wasn't a major voice in the Ellington trumpet section who was really influenced, inspired by Armstrong. And one was Cootie Williams, another would be Ray Nance. There's so much of Ellington's music that could have been perfect for Armstrong if he had ever had a chance to play with that band.
Popular as he was, Louis Armstrong never felt compelled to join the so-called modern jazz age. Bebop wasn't his favorite music, and he refused to play it. He once said, "It's all flash. It doesn't come from the heart the way real music should." But he respected jazz innovators, especially fellow trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie. There were rumors of a deep rift between the two. But Louis says that he and Dizzy were friends, and that Armstrong respected the younger man's work.
And the style that he's playing now came from jam session where he was putting in these riffs. But in the early days, we all know each other as just playing musicians. And he's my neighbor. We live in Corona together, and we visit each other's homes. And that's where we've always been since the first day we met.
I wasn't too much interested in anybody but Roy Eldridge. You see, Roy was greatly influenced by Louis Armstrong. So therefore, I didn't have to go that far back to get any influence from Louis Armstrong. All I had to do was listen to Roy. But after you leave the style of your influence, there are still remnants. Therefore, Louis Armstrong had remnants of King Oliver in his playing, even till he died. So Roy, the same way. I still have Roy and me, and whoever comes afterward. So therefore, I was influenced by Louis Armstrong, but not directly. But the more you learn, the more you appreciate Louis.
I'm Stanley Crouch. It's Satchmo, the wonderful world of Louis Armstrong, a very special edition of NPR's Jazz Profiles. Thank you.
Playing that horn night after night took a serious toll on Lewis physically, but he always took special care of his chops.
It takes a lot of trumpet players to get on the job to realize that they should have checked up on the chops before they left home. They wake up some morning and the baby's hanging on their shoulder like two beef hearts, and then they frantic, they don't know what to do. They're not thinking about a little witch hazel to mow them down from the swelling, a little sweet spirulina if there's any sting there, you know, put a little on cotton and saturate them chops and grab a chair for about 10 minutes and get that sting out of it. You can't blow a horn no how without having the soreness out your lips.
Craftsmen all over the world made special mouthpieces for Lewis. A German company even developed a special lip salve for him. Some of the mouthpieces were so sharp you could shave with them, but it never stopped Lewis from trying them out. Ruby Braff.
I saw him try out mouthpieces that you couldn't get a squeak through, and he didn't want to embarrass the person that brought him the mouthpiece, you know, the maker of it. And he said, geez, that's a wonderful, great mouthpiece. When the guy left, I looked at the mouthpiece. You couldn't even put a common pin into it. It wouldn't even fit, and yet he played it wonderfully. How did he do it? I don't know.
Lewis spent just as much time taking care of his horn, cleaning it every night. Lucille Armstrong.
Either he cleaned it or I cleaned it before. Once a week it was broken down, and you get this snake. It's a wire with brushes on each end. You run that through the long valves, you know. But at night, after each night after Louis finished blowing his horn, before he put it in his case, he would run water through it, get the salava out of this, and put a little oil in it before he put it away.
Pull that rod through it and that hot water. Make sure that there won't be any hamburgers from that long bus ride in there. And things like that, why the younger musician probably don't have time to be bothered with things like that. They're going to always make up their opinion about, he's pretty good. But I remember when that cat was really wailing, and if they just listen to that horn now, they're getting the best trumpet that I ever had in me.
As a trumpet player, Lewis Armstrong never let anyone or anything force him to compromise the high musical standards he adopted when he was a young man in New Orleans. He stayed true to himself until the end of his career, always challenging himself to improve on his flawless technique and impeccable style.
When the cats say, well, when you gonna retire? I say, well, why should I retire? Sit up and look at four walls, you know? A lot of people retire to die, so long as the horn ain't hurting me and we're getting along.
But in the late 1960s, playing the horn contributed to his declining health. Lewis had heart problems. He was always out of breath, and his doctors advised him to stop playing the trumpet. But a heart attack wasn't enough to stop him from making music. He continued to sing.
Yes, give me a kiss before you leave me. My imagination will feed my hungry heart. Leave me one thing before we part. Kiss the bill, the dream on. When I'm alone with my fancies, I'll be you. Weaving romances, making believe they're true. Babe, give me your lips for just a moment. My imagination will make that moment live.
give me what you alone can give. Just a melody man.
From his beginnings in New Orleans, all the way up through his world-traveling all-stars, Louis Armstrong's influence grew and reached beyond the traditional boundaries. He was a leading example of an artist and an entertainer who made lasting contributions to the culture.
It will always be something that we will gravitate toward because the sound has a wisdom in it that's not going to become less wise as time passes. It's a very humane sound. It has so much optimism in it. We always need that.
Wynton Marsalis on the value of Armstrong's contributions to American music as an innovator, improviser, accompanist, and master technician.
He was sent at that time to really document the New Orleans experience in music and let people know what is possible with this music. He had the force of personality to bring it around the world and carry the feeling and the meaning of it to people. And everywhere he went, people loved him and loved his music and accepted and imitated, emulated it. He made jazz live as an art.
The final word on Louis Armstrong, the trumpeter, was said by Armstrong himself in a silly movie starring Danny Kaye. When Kaye's character says of his own father to the young Armstrong in a Harlem jam session that he was the greatest trumpet player in the world, Armstrong looks at Danny Kaye and says, "If he ain't Gabriel, he's in trouble." I'm Stanley Crouch. We'll get together again next time on the wonderful world of Louis Armstrong.
Louis Armstrong, the trumpeter, was written and produced by Njamili Carol Jones. Technical director, Duke Marcos. The executive producer of The Wonderful World of Louis Armstrong is Jim Luce. The executive producer of Jazz Profiles is Tim Owens. Assistant producer, Madeline Smith. We'd also like to thank the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University in Newark, the Hogan Archives at Tulane University in New Orleans, Gary Giddens, Phoebe Jacobs, Bruce Rayburn, Jack Bradley, the BBC, WBGO in Newark, and DeCapo Press. To email us or for more information about this program and others in our series, visit NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for this edition of Jazz Profiles comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, seeking to enrich community life through support of education, arts, and culture. Additional support has been provided by Oris Swiss Watches since 1904, on the web at www.oris.ch, and by Carry Audio Design, makers of high-end audio equipment for the home, on the web at www.carryaudio.com. The Wonderful World of Louis Armstrong is produced by the Luce Group and National Public Radio in association with WRTI-FM Philadelphia as part of the Louis Armstrong Centennial Radio Project. I'm Nancy Wilson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thanks for listening. To hear more programs in this series, go to npr.org/jazzprofiles.